Dr. Jack Cusick is one of the rare biostatisticians who's had a central role in shaping oncology clinical research. Dr. Cusick recently published a fascinating meta-analysis of the impact of LHRH agonist in the adjuvant setting of breast cancer, and he began by putting this entire treatment area in perspective.
Yeah, it's interesting. The LHRH agonists are a really very much underused treatment. The trials have been around for some time, and individually, none of the trials has really been convincing as to what the best use of these are. So with the help of all of the authors, we managed to get all the individual patient data from virtually every trial in the world. We addressed two major questions. One is, are the LHRH agonists, when used alone, as good as chemotherapy? And the second question is, if they're used in addition to chemotherapy, do they provide any additional benefits?
I guess the other issue that people have a lot of questions about, and I'm not sure we have an answer to, is how would that compare to just using tamoxifen alone?
There weren't any direct comparisons against tamoxifen, but there was some evidence that it added to tamoxifen. Unfortunately, the question that's of most relevance, there are no trials in, and that is, if everybody gets tamoxifen, is adding an LHRH agonist the same as adding chemotherapy? And there are actually zero trials on that question, which is unfortunate because it is a key question right now.
And I guess the other thing is, are there, in the era of genomics and Oncotype DX, et cetera, are there any predictors in terms of what would be a better strategy?
Well, I think that's something for the next round. I mean, we're still keeping the group together, and I think it'll be important to try to pinpoint the groups. I mean, it's very clear that the estrogen receptor distinguishes patients that can benefit from these treatments, but undoubtedly, there are going to be more things as well. So we're keen to try to progress that.
Can you kind of summarize what we know about the impact?
There were three classes of trials. There were a few patients that did get just only an LHRH versus nothing, and there were only 338 patients in that. And the effects were pretty much as predicted, but not quite significant just because of small numbers. But they showed about a 30% reduction in recurrence and mortality. The next group of trials directly looked at an LHRH agonist versus chemotherapy, and most of that chemotherapy was CMF, but there were some anthracycline-based regimens in some of the trials as well. And that was about almost 4,000 patients in that grouping, and there the evidence was that they were essentially equally effective. I think one of the limitations is, of course, it is chemotherapy in an older era, but in fact, we could find no real difference for the anthracycline-based versus the CMF-based. But it does suggest that certainly for women with estrogen receptor-positive low-risk cancers, that an LHRH agonist plus tamoxifen is a reasonable option and that chemotherapy isn't necessary in all those cases.
Now, again, were these trials looking at LHRH agonist plus tamoxifen?
Some of them were, some of them weren't. This group of trials didn't have tamoxifen. There were then the third round of trials, which looked at the addition of an LHRH agonist to either chemotherapy or tamoxifen or both. And there the effects were a modest addition to those effects of the order of about a 10 to 15% improvement in recurrence and mortality. And that was true regardless of whether it was added to tamoxifen, chemotherapy, or both.
Our patterns of care studies in U.S.-based physicians, and we routinely do these, usually using a sample of about 150 randomly selected medical oncologists. And also, we have a cadre of more than 50 clinical investigators who specialize in breast cancer, and we also ask them these same questions. And what we've seen is an increasing use of adjuvant LHRH agonist, either with tamoxifen and actually now some with aromatase inhibitors. Of course, that's being studied in clinical trials. Any sort of way to put some numbers on how much of an additional benefit you get from an LHRH agonist?
It's still a complicated area because one of the things that we did find in this study is that when you looked at the addition of an LHRH agonist to chemotherapy, the effects were only there in the younger women under the age of 40. If you looked at the sort of later premenopause, we didn't see much of an effect. And some of the trials have reported, and it's quite reasonable, that in fact this relates to women who did not achieve amenorrhea on chemotherapy. And I think that's an area we want to go back and look more carefully at the data and try to collect that data on all of the trials that we can.
Yes, certainly. If you're going to induce ovarian suppression with chemotherapy, you wouldn't expect an LHRH agonist to add to that.
Yes, and that, of course, is age-related. So It would seem that the most useful indication after chemotherapy is in women who do not achieve amenorrhea, and there the benefits are the order of 20% reduction, 25% reduction mortality, quite useful.
So here's the question I really want to ask you. This is the thing that's really got me interested. In these studies of LHRH agonists and breast cancer, in general, what was the interval used? Was it monthly or 3 monthly ovarian suppression?
These are almost completely monthly injections, yeah.
What do we know about the impact of monthly versus every 3 month therapy in breast cancer specifically?
There's certainly a lot of interest in that because it would be much more convenient if it was 3 monthly. And the data I've seen suggests that for many women, actually 3 months can be achieved, but the results are somewhat variable. And not all women can actually get full suppression for 3 months with 3 month depo. So it's an area where there's some uncertainty, and I think enough uncertainty that it's not typically recommended to be used.
And I guess also the issue of adjuvant therapy, you're going for hopefully cure, different than in the metastatic setting where maybe considerations are different.
Sure.
So do you think that there's a consensus that when you're using adjuvant LHRH agonist, that ought to be every month?
I think that's the current feeling, yes, that monthly is appropriate.
And certainly a lot of the investigators that we've interviewed for this series all say that, and they have been quite surprised by this most recent study that we just did and is just about to publish showing that 40% of oncologists in the United States are using every three-month therapy for breast cancer. And interestingly, 24% of the 51 investigators are using it. Since I saw those data, which I was pretty surprised at, I've been asking people, and I've asked some pretty credible people, and most are using monthly. That's, you know, the information we have to deal with. But I had a little bit of concern about that.
That's an interesting point. I certainly wasn't aware of your survey, but the three-month depo, of course, is used in prostate quite
exactly,
often.
Exactly, right.
And it is available. The indications are that in some women, it actually doesn't hold for 3 months. So if you really want to get the full treatment, it's a little bit uncertain. But certainly it's substantially more convenient.
I guess the other issue is if you're combining it with tamoxifen, it's one thing. But if you're combining it with an AI and you're not going to totally suppress the ovaries, that would seem to be a little problematic.
Well, it'd be absolutely essential, I think, when combining with an AI, you make sure you maintain the ovarian suppression. I mean, I think that's the new frontier now for premenopausal endocrine treatment, which is, of course, being looked at in a number of trials. Is if you really go for estrogen suppression with LHRH plus AI, you know, what can you achieve there?
I want to shift into adjuvant therapy for the postmenopausal patient. But before I do, one of my favorite things I've been doing recently is asking people to predict the results of clinical trials.
Uh-huh.
So I want you to tell me, if you would, what your best guess is in terms of what the SOFT study is going to show, looking at tamoxifen versus tamoxifen plus ovarian suppression versus ovarian suppression plus an aromatase inhibitor. How do you think that's going to play out?
Well, I think that if you believe what we've seen in the postmenopausal trials, we know that an aromatase inhibitor is better than tamoxifen, and that's probably because of the estrogen agonist activities of tamoxifen, which was seen very clearly in the ATTACK trial. If you combined an AI with tamoxifen, essentially you got the same results of just using tamoxifen by itself. So one would suspect that, in fact, adding an AI to an LHRH agonist will be better than adding tamoxifen by about the same proportion, 25% additional improvement.
So we'll see what happens. That'd be my bet, too. And in a few minutes, I'm going to ask you to predict the results of the big study. But I want to get your take on some of the data that's been presented recently about the 2D6 issue in tamoxifen and whether or not maybe somehow that could enter into the equation to identify people who maybe could be started on tamoxifen. Could you kind of review that?
It's an interesting question. There is data now that there is a polymorphism in the 2D6 enzyme, which is the enzyme which actually metabolizes tamoxifen, and about 30% of the population have an enzyme which have a defect in that enzyme, which means they're poor metabolizers. So that works out at about a 10% of the population are actually homozygous for that enzyme, and those patients probably are not going to do well on tamoxifen at all and definitely need an AI. Whether or not that's enough to explain the overall benefits of an AI over tamoxifen, I sort of doubt it, because I think the population is probably too small. But that's an important research question and one that we don't really have any data on. We're currently trying to look at some of that in some of the trials we're doing at the moment.
Can you talk about where we are right now with there's been a lot of discussion and controversy now for the last 5 or 6 years about the optimal sequence or the optimal endocrine therapy in postmenopausal women? Of course, there have been models. You had a model. Hal Burstein had a model.
Yeah.
Where are we right now with that whole issue, and where do you think things are heading?
We've produced a model that actually looks at the data and also updates the data based on the most recent trial results. And what the model predicts is that the upfront treatment is going to be the best strategy, both in terms of efficacy and in terms of toxicity. The efficacy benefits above the switch strategy are modest, but I think there's been a lot of confusion about comparing the upfront treatments directly to the switching strategies because, of course, the switching trials only look at patients that got through 2 years without any side effects or recurrence, and it's a different population, the upfront strategy. So if you go back, and you can only do this by modeling, you can't do it by just looking at hazard ratios, and try to sort of look at what would happen if you looked at those patients from time zero, from when they initially start their adjuvant treatment. The model predicts that the upfront treatment is better. And that really isn't, to me, surprising. I mean, the best treatment upfront is likely to be the appropriate strategy in many circumstances.
Where are we right now in terms of other markers being able to sort out maybe subsets that might, you know, benefit differently? And I guess one that's talked a lot about is HER2 and also PGR.
Yeah, the ATTACK trial data we had a very interesting result in that the benefits of anastrozole over tamoxifen were particularly striking for the progesterone receptor negative patients. That has not been confirmed in the big 198 data. And also, we tried to go back and do central review of the receptors. Mitch Dowsett reported that this year on about 2,000 patients. And unfortunately, that was an unrepresentative sample of the overall trial. And if you just looked at the local lab results for those patients, there wasn't much of an effect either, which says that in the patients we didn't sample, there's an even bigger effect. But the central lab results confirm the local results in finding no clear differences there. So it's a question that's still a little bit open, and I think it's unlikely that we're really going to resolve that because I can't see any new data that's really going to clarify that. So there's no doubt about it that progesterone receptor negativity is a poor prognostic factor, as is HER2 positivity in these patients that didn't get Herceptin. But whether or not it's a differential predictive effect for AIs versus tamoxifen, it's unclear, and I think probably we'll never resolve that.
I guess particularly with HER2, we'll never see any significant cohorts now who don't get trastuzumab, so I guess we kind of have to look at that fresh if we can.
Yep.
Another thing that we saw in our patterns of care study was kind of interesting. We've seen a progressive shift since 2001 with the ATTACK data towards the use of upfront AIs, and that now clearly is the dominant initial strategy, at least in the United States. But one thing that's kind of interesting is you still see a little bit of a pocket within investigators, and you probably can guess who they are just from having dealt with people, who think that maybe tamoxifen should be considered in patients who are node negative. Can you talk about sort of the thinking behind that and whether you agree or disagree with it?
Well, I think I disagree. The only value of tamoxifen, I think, is in patients that do not tolerate the AIs. I mean, there are a subgroup of patients that get these arthralgias and really have lots of problems, and they're going to an AI makes sense. But by and large, the side effects of tamoxifen are worse than the side effects of the AIs, particularly for anastrozole, where the number of patients stopping treatment because of side effects was substantially and significantly higher on tamoxifen than on an AI. And we know there are problems with thromboembolic events and a range of gynecological problems, including endometrial cancer, a 4 times higher hysterectomy rate. So for low-risk patients, of course, the issues are more related to safety and tolerability than efficacy. And there, overall, the AIs are better. There clearly are some toxicities, and some patients do not tolerate them. So it clearly, in those cases, tamoxifen is better than nothing. But by and large, I think for the low-risk patient, it's the toxicity profile that makes them more attractive. And for the higher-risk patients, it's the efficacy profile. So I can't really see a group of patients for which you wouldn't want to start an AI first if you're going to give any endocrine treatment.
I guess the other thing is that in terms of side effects, you can always stop or change the drug. But in terms of complications such as endometrial cancer, deep vein thrombosis, or fracture, you know, that's a little bit of a different story. What do you think it's appropriate to say to a woman starting on an AI today, knowing what we know about bone, bisphosphonates, bone mineral density scanning, et cetera, as opposed to the trials where we didn't really, you know, have that input in terms of the risk of fracture to these women?
Well, that's one of the things we're looking at very carefully in our IBIS-2 prevention study. We're looking very carefully at whether or not, with a little bit of care and monitoring, whether or not the bone problem can be substantially reduced. All of the adjuvant trials had no special concerns about bone. There weren't DEXA scans up front. Clearly, it's appropriate to get a DEXA scan in a woman before she goes on an AI. And if there is osteoporosis or moderate to severe osteopenia, bisphosphonates are going to be effective in that group.
Just a sort of side point, at the 2006 ASCO meeting, Rob Coleman presented some data suggesting that maybe if the initial bone mineral density is okay, that these women maybe don't need to be monitored as often. What are your thoughts about that?
That data has now, I think, been accepted for publication from the ATTACK trial, and it has essentially found that if patients start off with normal bone density, none of them became osteoporotic over the 5 years of treatment. And the other interesting thing, which we'll be following very carefully, is that in the last analysis of the ATTACK trial, the fracture rate went back to the same as tamoxifen in year six. This year in San Antonio, we'll have 2 more years of follow-up on that. And if, in fact, the rebound is rapid and sustained and that the fracture risk only occurs over the active treatment period, I think that's very reassuring.
What are your thoughts about the issue of duration of the use of AIs? Obviously, there are a lot of trials now that are looking at going beyond 5 years. Our whole sensitivity to the issue of the time course of recurrence in ER-positive tumors has really changed a lot in the last few years. What's your take on that whole issue?
I think the question of duration of endocrine treatment is probably one of the key questions now. For AIs, that's a key question as to whether or not we should go beyond 5 years. I would like to see a really large pragmatic trial in which maybe in some patients, even the low-risk patients, might be randomized to 3 versus 5 years. To some extent, a lot of this switching strategy, I think, is the fact that AIs are more expensive than tamoxifen. So you can give tamoxifen for 2 years and an AI for 3 years. It may be better to just give the AI for 3 years up front. So I think 3 years versus 5 years of an AI is an interesting question for your lower-risk patient. For your average to higher risk patient, I think 5 versus 10 is a very important question.
What do you think is going on when you see drops in recurrence rates when you start an AI, you know, after 5 years of tamoxifen, you know, maybe even with a delay of a few years after having had tamoxifen, and you still see drops in recurrence rate? Some people have kind of made an analogy to a prevention type scenario, although obviously this is recurrence we're talking about. What's going on there?
Well, I mean, breast cancer is striking by the fact that the recurrence rate never really drops below 2%, even out to 20 years. So it's a disease with a very long recurrence rate. And it's hard for me to believe that those are all just true recurrences. I think many of those must, to some extent, be development of lesions that are at least not fully invasive at the time of diagnosis. So there's a mixture of prevention and treatment. And I think that mixture gets blurred in some of these cases. But the data, I think, are really quite impressive that longer treatment in many patients is likely to be good. We've looked at that in our modeling poster this year at ASCO and also come to the conclusion that there are benefits of 10 years of treatment.
Speaking of duration, I've been hearing rumors about the ATLAS and ATOM studies looking at 10 versus 5 years of tamoxifen. What's going on there?
Well, there are reported data. I think it's probably one of the best kept secrets in the world. Everybody has seen these data, but they're not actually in the public domain at this stage. So, yeah, they should be out hopefully soon, be able to talk about them more fully.
Yeah, it is vexing to try to pull this out of you all because we're getting the hint that there's an advantage to longer therapy, which of course would be amazingly ironic considering the fact that a few years ago we thought there was actually a detrimental effect.
Yeah. I mean, it's really important that the ATLAS trial was done because it was a little counterintuitive that treatment would stop being effective. Maybe the side effect profile would increase. That's not surprising, but it's kind of surprising that continued suppression would not produce some benefit. And I guess the indications are there is going to be a benefit there, yes.
And if that is the way it plays out, what do you think is going to explain the NSABP finding in node-negative patients that, quote, there was a detrimental effect? Do you think that was just statistics?
Yeah, I think it was over-interpretation of small numbers, basically.
Can you talk a little bit about where we are in terms of the issue of risk for cardiovascular disease? You and I have talked about that in the past. Where are we right now on this issue?
I think it's an important issue. The ATTACK data showed a small increase in cardiovascular disease overall, but when you looked at that, it was only mild and moderate angina. In terms of severe angina, myocardial infarction, deaths from cardiac disease, there was virtually no difference in the two groups. I think 47 versus 42 deaths, if I remember correctly, from cardiac disease. So I think for anastrozole, we're quite reassured that there isn't a cardiac risk. And that's very reassuring for the prevention IBIS 2 study that we have this data and we're monitoring it very, very carefully. With letrozole, particularly the big 198 data, the published data does suggest potential risk. It's based on fairly early data, but although the numbers are small, the risk is about a twofold risk for a myocardial infarction. So I think it's just a concern at this stage that this may be a problem. I'd like to see some more data. But if there is a cardiac problem there, it's something that is important, absolutely.
What about eczema stain?
Again, the early data did show an excess cardiac death. Some of the more recent analysis suggest that may not be quite so strong, but there still is an excess of deaths from cardiac disease in the IES study.
Right, and that's a switching kind of a scenario. And I guess the other thing that comes up is the question of, is this sort of a detrimental effect of an AI or just a positive effect of tamoxifen? And I guess the MA17 data looks at letrozole versus placebo, and they don't seem to see that. Is that your take?
My take is that when we've tried to look at the cardiac benefits of tamoxifen, they've never really been all that clear. We never found it in our prevention study, although it's been seen in some other places. So there's no doubt that tamoxifen leads to lower LDL cholesterol levels, but how that translated into real benefits in cardiac mortality is not yet clear at all.
Can you kind of put in context what the magnitude of this potential risk is, if it actually exists, and maybe it exists for one AI or not, but is this a statistical thing because the trials are so big, or is it really something clinically meaningful?
I think it is clinically meaningful, particularly if you're going to start treating the lower risk patients. If you look at the number of events, it's small. It's of the order of 25 versus 50, I think, in the big 198 study, where the recurrence rates are tenfold higher than that. So for your average risk woman, it's not critical. It's certainly critical if you're going to use these drugs in prevention or going to start thinking about using them for DCIS or very small tumors.
Speaking of DCIS, and I want to ask you about prevention too, but as you mentioned DCIS, I guess we have at least two major studies that are sort of out there cooking. One of the NSABP, and the other actually is part of the IBIS trial looking at tamoxifen versus anastrozole, as the NSABP trial does. When do you think we might get some answers from this? And again, what do you think it's going to show?
The IBIS-2 trial is recruiting steadily. It'll be another 2 or 3 years before we're really ready to report that data. It's certainly been something that's attracted interest across all of Europe and even other parts of the world. So it's recruiting really quite well.
Of course, the NSABP trial is closed, so maybe we'll see that first.
And of course, that probably will report first, actually, as they do recruit very well. Well, I guess our expectation is that the benefit that was seen of AIs over tamoxifen will be maintained for DCIS. Actually, we know that from the B24 data, that ER-positive DCIS does respond to tamoxifen and would expect it to respond even better to an AI. So that's certainly the hope for these trials. I have to wait and see, though.
What about the issue of the optimal sequence, and specifically the big 198 study that, of course, started out with four arms or four issues, tamoxifen versus letrozole, which seems like we have the answer to in terms of 5 years versus 5 years, but then those two intriguing switching arms, 2 to 3 years of letrozole followed by tamoxifen, tamoxifen followed by letrozole. When do you think you might have some answers, and what do you think we're going to see?
Well, I gather that's not going to be available even later this year, so it's probably next year before we'll even get the first hint of that.
Are they going to have enough events? I mean, is the trial powered?
That's one of the concerns, is that, in fact, of the 8,000 patients, I think only 6,000 went into the four-way treatment. So we're only talking about 1,500 patients per arm. And based on what we've seen in modeling, the key question, and that is an AI up front better than 2 years of tamoxifen followed by an AI? That's going to be essentially only 3,000 patients contributing to that. And we know the differences are going to be quite small. So my expectation is that trial will not be definitive on that question.
I've got a little bit of hope for the letrozole followed by tamoxifen arm, just because it seems kind of cool and, and this whole thing about resetting the estrostat and all this stuff. So, I mean, maybe there will be a big difference.
Now, yeah, that was the other question. I mean, the other arm for which they're the only trial that's doing anything is the, the reverse switch, giving AI first then followed by tamoxifen. I think that's totally uncharted territory in terms of what's going to happen. Some people think that this could be a terribly bad thing, that indeed by giving an AI you make the cancer cells exquisitely sensitive to any kind of estrogenic stimulus, and then hitting with tamoxifen is going to lead to a big flare-up of tumors and you might see a lot of recurrences. There are others think it may be setting it up so that tamoxifen actually is more toxic. So it's an open question. I think it's an important question to try to get an answer for, and that's the only data we'll probably have on that question. So we'll have to wait and see.
Let's talk a little bit about the prevention setting. Can you review what the IBIS-1 trial looked at and where we are in the data set? And, of course, the IBIS-2 study looking at anastrozole versus placebo, pretty interesting randomization. Where are we right now with both of those trials?
The IBIS-1 study, of course, was begun some time ago, I guess in 1998, and published once, and like all the trials, we show essentially about a 50% reduction in new ER-positive breast cancer no effect on ER-negative tumors. But the European trials have actually kept themselves blinded. That study plus the Royal Marsden study, which originally was the pilot study for IBIS-1, have been ongoing, and we recently updated the follow-up and reported that earlier this year. And the results were really very exciting, I think as good as we could have ever hoped for, and that is the benefit in the 5 years after you stop treatment was actually larger than the benefit in the 5 years of active treatment.
Counterintuitive.
Not actually. Because cancer is a long process. You know, we're talking about carcinogenesis here. We're not talking about treating. There are precursor lesions that are developing over 20, 30 years.
Although, I mean, I think a lot of people thought we weren't talking about carcinogenesis. We were talking about suppression of subclinical disease.
Sure.
But maybe we are talking about
it. Yeah, well, I think, you know, even in the overview of the adjuvant studies, we've seen this extended carryover benefit in years 5 to 10 after, you know, when giving 5 years of tamoxifen. And it looks like in earlier disease, the effect is even larger. So the tamoxifen is more than just cytostatic. You're actually curing some patients. And these unidentifiable subclinical lesions that are partway on the path are also being cleaned up. So it's kind of like you're sterilizing the breast, getting rid of all of the sort of partially converted lesions.
Or half of them.
At least in some cases, certainly not in all cases. And it reminds me a lot of, you know, the effects of taking out adenomas in colorectal screening. You know, once you've taken out the precursor lesions, the benefit lasts 10, 20 years.
What about in the IBIS trial? Can you talk a little bit more about what happens in those second 5 years?
So the IBIS trial, when we first reported the results, we wrote to all the women and told them that we had found this early effect, but we weren't convinced that it was sufficiently strong that we should unblind them. And of course, they all had the choice to be unblinded. I think one out of the 7,000 chose to be unblinded at that stage. And we did recommend that they stay with the treatment, stay on follow-up. We've continued to follow them up through essentially passive record systems in the UK and Australia, and now have essentially about an 8-year median follow-up, with a lot of women actually being out to 10 years. And the results were really very, very encouraging for this continued benefit. The women now, when they get to 10 years, are being offered the chance to join the IBIS-2 study once they've had a 10-year follow-up on IBIS-1. So I think we would like to look at how long this lasts, but we recognize that after 10 years, it probably is appropriate for many of these women who are now at risk to consider an AI.
Can you talk a little bit about the IBIS-2 trial, what the eligibility is for entry, and what are some of the sub-studies that you're going to be looking at?
Yeah, the IBIS-2 study essentially uses similar kinds of entry criteria as the previous trials. Most of them are based on family history. A mother or sister with breast cancer under the age of 50, or two breast cancers in the family. One of the new groups that we've actually included, although it's not being used as much as we'd like, is mammographic density. Women who have more than 50% of the breast covered with dense, opaque areas on the mammogram are also eligible. And this is probably in the future, to my mind, the group that are going to be most useful for identifying increased risk. Those women are then offered the chance to join the trial, and the trial is anastrozole versus placebo for 5 years. All of the women get a DEXA scan at baseline. We're also offering the first 1,000 women in the study a chance to join a bone sub-study, which we think is potentially going to be the most informative about the effects of AI on bone, because it's got against placebo control. And they're split into three strata. The first strata is women who have normal bone density, that is, T-score is greater than -1, and those women basically are just being monitored. They get a baseline DEXA and then a DEXA at years 1, 3, 5, and then at year 7, 2 years after the completion of treatment to see what happens there.
But you're doing interventions, aren't you, based on what you see?
In that group, we would only intervene if they become osteoporotic.
Hmm.
The third stratum is women who are osteoporotic at baseline, and there we allow them to join the study, but we insist that they get bisphosphonate concomitantly, and that's going to be a reasonably small strata because it's not a large population. But the most interesting group are those with osteopenia, where there's some loss of bone. Not so atypical for that age, but it's certainly a bit lower. There, we're actually looking at whether or not it's appropriate to simply just monitor them with a DEXA scan or to give a bisphosphonate up front. So there'll be 400 women in that group who are randomized in addition to either take a bisphosphonate or a matching placebo, and they're being followed as well. The first results on that will actually be available in San Antonio this year. We're going to be reporting on about about the first 600 women that have had the baseline and the one-year scan to look at what's happened in the first year, at least, anyway.
Do you know what it shows yet?
I do, but I think it's confidential at this stage.
Okay, you can tell me in San Antonio. Do you have any data from that study on the quality of life and arthralgias?
Certainly the arthralgia data is being recorded routinely.
Have you seen it yet?
We've reported some of that. Yes, the initial data, there was some interest as to whether or not the arthralgias were associated with low levels of vitamin D. And we felt this was sufficiently important that we should look at this in our data. So we've basically looked at the arthralgias reported in the first year and looked to see whether or not there's any predictive value of baseline vitamin D levels, and we couldn't find any effect at all. So the arthralgia data, essentially we see not a surprising, somewhat higher rates, not enormously higher in the anastrozole arm.
It's a little confusing when, like in the attack data and similar data, is trying to dissect out. I mean, oncologists talk a lot about this issue because it was compared to tamoxifen. Tamoxifen rate was like 30%, and it's just kind of hard to make anything out of it. Any way to put all that together?
I think it reminds me of most clinicians, if you ask them, are convinced that tamoxifen leads to weight gain. It's almost a universal belief amongst many, many clinicians. But yet, if you look at the placebo-controlled data in IBIS-1, P1, or B14, there's just as much weight gain on placebo as there is on tamoxifen. There's no difference whatsoever. I think that's a useful thing to remember, because if you look at the arthralgias in the attack trial, I think it's 30% on tamoxifen, 36% on an AI. So there is a real effect, but it's a small effect compared to the fact that arthralgia is not uncommon in early postmenopausal years anyway. I don't think that's a tamoxifen effect. I think that simply reflects the arthralgia reports in this population independent of treatment. So I think that to some extent the AIs are getting blamed for some of the arthralgias that they don't cause. There's no doubt that they do increase the risk, but there are a lot of arthralgias that are going to occur anyway. We'll again learn more about that from the IBIS-2 study, because we'll be comparing anastrozole to placebo, so we'll have the real placebo arm, and there's no doubt that there's a fair amount of arthralgia in the placebo arm.
Well, also from a clinical point of view, when you have a problematic patient, you really want to have them on an AI, maybe they have a node-positive tumor, et cetera, and you can't. I mean, it's something that kind of sticks out in your mind, but we even have a little patterns of care data on that. It's very interesting what docs actually will tell you and researchers, because what we said, and we've asked this several times now, is what fraction of patients that you start on an AI have enough of a problem from your point of view of arthralgias that you consider switching or doing something about it? And they actually came up with a similar number, both the investigators and the docs in practice.
That's interesting.
What do you think the number is?
I think the number is probably 25%, but I think it's too high.
They said 10 to 12%.
Okay. Well, that's
and that's kind of in line with what you just said about the attack trial.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's probably more like 5 to 10%, actually, but we'll see.
But again, at least from their point of view, and I guess from the data we have, you wouldn't think it would be, you know, 25 or 50%.
The other thing we should probably talk about is not only is the question of duration important for aromatase inhibitors, but I think one of the things that comes out of the LHRH overview is the question of how long ovarian suppression should take place. The trials varied from, I think, 18 months at the low end up to 5 years at the high end, and there isn't really enough data, nor are there any direct comparisons. So I think an important area in terms of the premenopausal endocrine treatment is how long should ovarian suppression take place, and it would be nice to see some trials of 2 versus 5 years.